service is not an affirmative force. It simply reoccupies the space vacated by the light.
This is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio.
It should be uncomfortable for a believer to live as a hypocrite.
Delivering people out of the bondage of mainstream media
and the philosophies of this world.
God has called you and me to be his ambassadors, even in this dark moment. Let's not miss our moment.
And now, the Hamilton Corner.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Hamilton Corner here on American Family Radio. Abraham Hamilton III is my name. I am the host of this program. I am joined by the Corner contingent right across from me, my grimacing, lamenting, and frustrated man, 100 grand, Mr. Bobby Rosa, is right across from me. Just played a little snippet of something I'm planning to show during air during the program. He's like, what? So I'll give him a longer Rosa with the roll because we're on a roll today. And in the screening room, we have producer extraordinaire. Often imitated, never duplicated. Y'all know what it is. The real J Mac, ladies and gentlemen, and we're ready to rock and roll with today's program. It is, I guess I'll say it this way, in an era of patently evident shifting and sinking sand, wisdom requires that you fasten yourself to the immovable rock who is higher than us. Wisdom portends that reality. At this very moment, many of you, if not most of you, are making your transitions from your part-time jobs where you generate an income to your full-time jobs where you cultivate an income. I describe it as I do because what goes on in your house is far more important. Even in an election season, what goes on in your house is far more important than what goes on in the White House. You and I are responsible and accountable for what we do with the time, the talent, and the resources God has afforded to us. We must resist the temptation to allow the things that swirl around us to take us away from job number one, to distract us away from what should be our focus. We must resist that. So as you're making your transition to your full-time jobs, I want to encourage you to do so with intentionality, understanding the significance and the primacy that God places on the family. God knows that everybody is at a different stage, at a different place in our lives. God knows this. And the faithfulness he requires of us starts first and foremost with us. The things that we are engaged in, the Lord's desire is for them to be the overflow of what we enjoy with him and in him personally. So I want to challenge and encourage you with the time that God has given you, with the oxygen he affords you, with the organs that are functioning, the blood flowing through your body. None of that is your own. You didn't create it. But with the grace that God has given you for life, take full advantage of it. Take full advantage of it. Don't miss your moment. God has placed us for this time and this context, knowing full well what would unfold. And he nevertheless saved you, saved me, those of us who are saved. And those of you who are tuning in, and you know, Abe, I like the other stuff, you know, the Bible stuff. I don't know necessarily where I am on that. Listen, there's a reason why you keep coming to this program. It's no secret that we open every show with the scripture. And there's a reason why you keep coming. As the Lord draws you, do not harden your heart. Do not harden your heart. The things that are unfolding around us confirm the fact that the Bible is true. The Bible is true from the beginning all the way through the end, where the Apostle John records Jesus explaining how the book will be opened, the Lamb's Book of Life, where every believer's name will be listed and included, and the books will be opened that record all of the doings of every individual. You don't want to risk. Well, let me say it this way. Eternity is a long, painful time to be wrong. A long and painful time to be wrong. Let's go to the Word of God. Today, we're going to go to the book of Habakkuk. Yes, Habakkuk, chapter 2. Habakkuk is a prophet described by many theologians as a minor prophet simply because of the length, or the lack thereof, of his book. We should never misconstrue the description of prophets as major or minor to be synonymous with a communication of significance, because all of God's prophets are major in significance. Habakkuk prophesied and ministered to the southern kingdom of Judah, dating at about 612 BC. So this is shortly before the Babylonian siege and ultimate conquest was culminated. All right. And it's an amazing book. The Lord allows us to peer into the heart and mind of one of his servants, Habakkuk. And it shows God responding to Habakkuk's pleas. You know, and when we read the scripture, and I've said this before, when we navigate scripture, what we should first and foremost look for is God revealing aspects of himself to us, revealing his character, revealing his nature, revealing his attributes to us. In this book, just to give you context and get right to what I want to convey to you today, Habakkuk witnessed the spiritual, social, moral decline that was transpiring in Judah, and he cried out to God about it. Like, Lord, I see all of this stuff. Why are you causing me to see all of this? Are you going to do anything? Are you going to intervene? And I know many of you, like myself, have felt like that, looking at different things happening. The conversation we had yesterday, where you have a state who made the decision, we're going to protect our children, and in many instances, protect them from malicious adults who are around them that are more than willing to sacrifice the children for a political agenda. And even a medical establishment that is willing to violate the Hippocratic Oath in order to make money. We want to protect all of them. So we're not going to allow children to be mutilated in this state. Or to take medications that could castrate them chemically, that will infect them for life based on one portion of their lives, which is in adolescence. How many times do we hear people saying, well, you know, children's brains aren't fully formed until this later age yet, because of the insanity of the socio-political environment, we're willing to allow people to irrevocably mar their bodies. It's insane. And then to add insult to injury, to have the current federal governmental administration to intervene in the case to say, no, state, you can't protect your children. Guys, that's absurd and insane. That's crazy town. But we can't act like or live like God doesn't see. So the book of Habakkuk records that exchange between God and Habakkuk about this phenomenon. But then there's an aspect here, because the Lord reveals to Habakkuk, oh, no, I'm going to judge the situation. And in fact, I'll tell you specifically. There's something going to happen that has never been seen, never been heard yet. And he tells Habakkuk that his instrument of judgment will be the Babylonians. He tells him specifically. Now, this is years before Nebuchadnezzar shows up. All right. But he tells him. But then he says this, and some people misunderstand this portion of scripture, but this reveals an aspect of God's character. Habakkuk chapter 2, just verses 2 and 3. This is after the second question that Habakkuk raises to God, and God responds to him, and Habakkuk records it in verse 2. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision. Some translations say write the vision there. Record the vision and inscribe it on tablets, that the one who reads it may run. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens towards the goal, and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it, for it will certainly come. It will not delay. Now, unfortunately, there have been many people who have, you know, chopped that text out of its context and made it to represent it as if it meant something that it completely does not mean. Some have said that, oh, well, when you have an idea, have a vision, that there's some mystical, magical thing that transpires when you write it on paper. And that, honestly, that is just a perversion of what the scriptures say. That's not what the text is saying at all. What the Lord is saying to Habakkuk, he's saying to him that what I'm revealing to you, I want you to write it down, because there are people who are coming after you who will be in the throes of what I'm explaining to you that is going to happen. They need to be able to gather their bearings in the midst of what's going to happen so that they can know how they will respond. Hence the reference to the metaphor write it on tablets so that the one who reads it, they may run. That the one who reads it, they will understand what's happening, know how to navigate what's happening, and know how to respond in light of what I have already revealed beforehand, what was going to transpire. What God was saying to Habakkuk is, your prayer to me and the dialogue that we are engaging in is not only for your benefit personally. We have a book of Habakkuk because of Habakkuk's obeying God's instruction to him here. He is saying to Habakkuk, write down what I'm revealing to you. Make it clear, concise, precise, and comprehensible so that the ones who are coming later, they will know how to respond. This is the word of God. And the Lord revealing to us an aspect of his character. That in the midst of all of the chaos, you can imagine what Habakkuk was seeing. It's kind of similar to what we're seeing today. What the Lord is saying, that even in the face of the chaos that is swirling, and in this specific instance, my judgment upon Judah, he still reveals his character that he is a merciful and gracious God, because he is still providing insight and guidance for his people in the face of looming judgment. This is amazing to behold. It even causes Habakkuk later in this epistle, not epistle, in his writings, in his book. Oh, it's in chapter 3. Where did I put it? Where's the note? Where Habakkuk exclaims, Lord, you are merciful. Be merciful even in judgment. Because he is. Because he is. Oh, I'm going to find it. I didn't plan on mentioning that part. But what I want you to see through this is this aspect of God revealing himself in this way to Habakkuk, that even in the face of looming, imminent judgment, the Lord is guiding, giving wisdom, and giving guidance to his people. He's giving guidance to his people. This is amazing to consider, guys. And when we recognize that this is how God has revealed himself to us in Scripture, and this is what I wanted to emphasize today, when we recognize that this is the God that we serve, we should seek him. We must seek him. God isn't allowing us to see. Bobby made the point of reference to something I'm going to talk about soon. He's like, man, nobody's covering this kind of stuff. Brothers and sisters, God doesn't open our eyes just so we can run around and say, act like we know more than other people. Oh, we see, nobody else sees. Man, why doesn't anybody? No, the Lord shows us things and reveals things to us so that we respond accordingly. Since he is merciful, since he is abundant in compassion, since he does provide guidance for his people, even in the face of approaching catastrophe, why wouldn't we seek him? A couple weeks ago, I was talking about Jonah and how the Ninevites, at that juncture in their nation's history, man, they repented. When you study the Ninevites and you know how, frankly, wicked the Ninevites were, you once again get to see, man, God is compassionate and he's merciful. We must seek him. We shouldn't just pay attention to acquire information. We shouldn't just have our eyes open so that we can have, you know, coffee shop banter. That we respond accordingly. Among the things that are on the front burner, if you will, the people of God must cry out to God that the Lord would be merciful to us. Not because we deserve it, no, but because he is merciful, and that he would give us grace through a reprieve to allow us to work. Because if the Lord gives us a reprieve, it's not for us to just exhale. It's because he's allowing us more time and opportunity to work.
Those who place their faith in Jesus are elevated to an extraordinary position. As co-heirs with Christ, we share in his inheritance. The gospel is the ultimate dignity giver, elevating the unworthy to unimaginable heights. Our lives should reflect this dignity, empowering us to extend the same grace and love to others that has been so generously given to us. I'm Jordan Shambly, and you can read the rest of The Gospel Dignifies the Undignified on thestand.net.
Shining light into the darkness, this is the Hamilton Corner on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Hamilton Corner. Abraham Hamilton III here. The reference was in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 2, where Habakkuk talks about God appealing to him as to be merciful, as merciful in the midst of wrath. But glory to his wonderful name. I meant to talk about this actually earlier this week, but I didn't get to it. And then I was on Today's Issues earlier having a conversation about this story I'm about to bring up now. It's remarkably sad and interesting that we're having to have these conversations now. So Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia, he had the unmitigated gall and audacity to actually follow Virginia's state law and to work to purge the voter rolls in the state from illegal voters. In particular, what Governor Glenn Youngkin is attempting to do, has been doing. In fact, the law was passed, dates back to 2006. What he has been doing is something that has been occurring for quite some time before now. Yet, the Department of Justice has now filed a lawsuit dating back to last week against Governor Glenn Youngkin and the state of Virginia, accusing them of violating a federal law that prohibits adjustments to voter rolls within 90 days of a federal election. This federal law dates back to the Reconstruction era after the Emancipation Proclamation. It dates back to the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments to our U.S. Constitution that sought to prohibit the former slaveholding states of the Confederacy from disenfranchising the descendants of slaves and slaves from being able to participate in civic procedures. Some people fail to recall that the Ku Klux Klan was actually the thuggish domestic terroristic enforcement arm of the Democrat Party that sought to prevent predominantly more melanated people, descendants of African slaves brought to this country against their will, and African slaves themselves, as well as their less melanated allies in our nation. Some people forget that part of the Ku Klux Klan's objectives. but that is what the federal law was meant to prevent, because the domestic terrorists, also known as the Klan, were trying to move states to purge voter rolls of more melanated peoples. Well, that is not what Governor Glenn Youngkin was doing. And he explained that the mechanism for the voter roll purge is because of the individual's self-attestation to their lack of citizenship. So you had some, they would apply for driver's license and other things, and in their interactions with the state government, they would check a box where they would attest to the fact that they were non-citizens, or they would leave the citizenship box unmarked. So that would trigger the information department to send that information to the Department of Elections, where they would compare the name of the individuals to their voting rolls and see whether or not if the person who is just attested by their own admission that they are non-citizens or that they've refused to affirm their citizenship in their application and interacted with the state to see if they're on the voter rolls. If they were, the state would send out one of numerous contact efforts to say, well, you need to affirm your citizenship in order to stay on the voter rolls. Does this not sound like it makes sense? Well, the Department of Justice, you guys know what the attack line is. The Department of Justice has sued the state of Virginia, the same Department of Justice that intervened in the case against the state of Tennessee when they sought to protect minors, the same one. saying that they're violating federal law, and it's and their statement is, oh, you can't do this because it's too close to the election date. I want you to listen to and watch Glenn Youngkin schooling Jake Tapper on this point. It's clip number one. Go.
Why not just honor that 90-day period?
Well, let me just first begin. It's anything but a purging program. It begins with someone identifying themselves as a non-citizen. And I guess I would posit back to you, do you think that non-citizens, when they've self-identified as a non-citizen, should stay on the voter roll and therefore be in a position to potentially vote in a presidential
election?
I don't think
any non-citizen should vote. How are they self-identifying? How does that happen?
They actually tick a box that says, I am a non-citizen, or they do not answer the question that they are a citizen. And therefore, they self-identify that they are not a citizen in the United States of America. And this is why this is so out of bounds in my mind from the Justice Department. They fully understand this. They understand the process starts with a person self-identifying as a non-citizen. And then there is a match with that person's name on the voter rolls. And they are given not just one, but up to three times in order to try to cure it. And this is why I find this to be a very, very unreal moment that is stunning, that they filed this suit 25 days before a presidential election, when in fact this has been going on in accordance with our Constitution, the federal Constitution, and state law since 2006.
Now, that's the governor of the state of Virginia, guys. Of course, you know, you have the spin doctors that are going to try to explain it in a different way. But if what the governor said is true, and I can tell you it was because I checked it out myself, it is true, that they've been doing this for years. Why, pray tell, would the federal government wait until 25 days before the election to file this lawsuit? Anybody want to? One is you have to get within the 90-day threshold in order to utilize that federal law, because otherwise, what would be the basis for the federal government to intervene in a state process concerning votes? Because the Constitution grants the states the authority to determine time, manner, and place of elections. And it, you know, and I do not enjoy this stuff being true. But I cover these things because I want you to have, let me say it this way, a comprehensive story. Because at first blush, you know the way that the lying, talking snake media describes these things. They're going to talk about, oh, this is, you know, this is voter disenfranchisement, this is this. But when you hear that the thing that actually triggers the electoral roll analysis is a self-attestation to a lack of citizenship, should not the onus be on the one who says, I'm not a citizen, to demonstrate, okay, if you're not a citizen, can you prove how and why you should be eligible to vote? It's just sickening that these are things are happening over and over in different ways, in different contexts. It's just unfortunate. It's very, very, very unfortunate. You got this. You have this story, and I got a bunch of stuff, man. It's not fun for me to cover these things. I alluded to this yesterday. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, Kamala Harris's running mate, was at a series of fundraising events. One in California alongside Gavin Newsom. Another in Seattle, Washington. To where Tim Walz expressed his disdain for the Electoral College and his desire for it to be abolished. Just said it flat out. And I'm going to read you the quote from the fundraiser. And in the process of expressing his desire to see the Electoral College abolished, which, by the way, the Electoral College is created constitutionally. So to abolish the Electoral College, you would have to amend the United States Constitution. That's theirs, that pesky little fact, you know. But he also spoke derisively about having to travel to far-flung counties. And he mentioned specifically three areas: Beaver County, Pennsylvania; York, Pennsylvania; Reno, Nevada. He mentioned four. I'm sorry, Western Michigan. He lamented the fact that they would have to travel and campaign in those areas. His exact quote from the California fundraiser is this, quote, this is Tim Walz, quote, I think all of us know the Electoral College needs to go. We need a national popular vote. But that's not the world we live in. So we need to win in Beaver County, Pennsylvania. We need to be able to go into York, Pennsylvania and win. We need to be in Western Michigan and win. We need to be in Reno, Nevada and win. Well, news of Tim Walz's wonderful expression of his civic-mindedness reached the Harris campaign, and immediately they send out press releases, send out publicists to say that Tim Walz's opinion on the Electoral College is not the Harris-Walz campaign's policy on Electoral College. Did y'all hear what I just said? Guys, I kid you not. It happened the same night. They're sending out all kind of stuff. Tim Walz's expression of his desire to want to abolish the Electoral College is not the campaign position on Electoral College. Which makes me stop. And again, you want to talk about competency. So y'all come go with me for a moment. Do y'all think the Harris campaign folks didn't know Tim Walz's position on the Electoral College before they asked him to be the running mate? Huh? Do you think they're surprised to learn that this is what Tim Walz thinks about the Electoral College? So then, to try to cover this all up, Tim Walz gets a softball interview with Michael Strahan, All Tooth Gaps Matter, at ABC. And he tried to explain away what he has said. Listen to and watch this clip. It's clip number two. Go.
I want to go back to something you said on Tuesday. You said, I think all of us know the Electoral College needs to go. But the campaign came out later that night, and they said that's not their stance. Yeah.
Well, it's not the campaign's position. And the point I'm trying to make is that there's folks that feel every vote must count in every state. Mm-hmm. And I think some of folks feel that's not the case. Our campaign does that. And the point I'm saying is, I'm in 5 states in 2 days. We're out there making the case that the campaign's position is clear, that that's not their position. Their position and my position is to make sure that everybody understands their vote, no matter what state they're in, matters.
So that's something that you and Vice President Harris disagree on?
I have spoken about it in the past that she's been very clear on this, and the campaign, and my position is the campaign's position.
I'm sorry, I started laughing during the clip. Boy, I'm telling these people something else. So Strahan, right? I'm glad he asked the question. So your position, you disagree with Kamala Harris on the Electoral College. Now, why would he ask that question? He tried to hit you with the slide. Well, I've spoken about it in the past. Oh, my friend, you've done more than spoken about it in the past. You, as governor of Minnesota, you have signed the National Popular Vote Compact. That's more than speaking about it. You have repeatedly expressed your disdain for the Electoral College. So again, let's go back to my previous question. Do y'all think that Harris Imhoff folks didn't know what he thought about the Electoral College before they tapped him to be his running mate? Or did they know, pick him anyway, but just hoped and expected him not to say that part out loud anywhere to anybody until, you know, later? Now, just think. They knew what he thought. Years ago, he signed the National Popular Vote Compact. Now, they knew what he thought. He stated what he thought. And that's who they want on the ticket. Because I've said to you before, these people have embraced Marxist policies. Marxist penchant despise the Constitution. This is the same Tim Walz who said one person's communist is another person's neighborliness. That's what he said. And he tried to cover it. All we're trying to say is that we want every person's vote in every state to count. Guys, that's just a flat lie. If you ditch the Electoral College system, you make even less significant the votes of many people. Why am I saying that? I'm so glad you asked. Do you realize that 50% of the entire United States population live in just 9 states? Do you realize? And a lot of you do realize that. But more than half of our national population all live in just 9 states. New York City, for example, has more people in it than 39 other states in our union. Los Angeles County has a higher population than 41 states in our union. You see, what this national popular vote scheme is, and frankly, you know, they try to say he misspeaks, but when you conveniently misspeak about, oh, I don't know whether or not you carried weapons in war, whether or not you were actually in war, whether or not you were actually in Hong Kong during Tiananmen Square. I just don't speak good. My wife knows I'm just a knucklehead. Dude, you a liar. You're not misspeaking. You're lying. And what you said at this fundraiser, when you're hanging out with a bunch of your Democrat friends and Gavin Slewsome, Twosome Newsome, you kind of let your hair down a little bit and you start saying what you really believe. And the campaign hits you with a rebuke, kind of like a puppy being smacked on the nose. And you're like, what I said wasn't the campaign's position. Dude, ain't you number 2 on the ticket for the campaign? But these folks lie. So when he says we want everybody's votes in the states to count, he's lying. No, he wants to shift the balance of power away from where it is currently with the Electoral College to balance it, to move it over to states that they prefer. I'll explain more on the other side of this break.
The following is from an article by Dr. Jessica Peck, host of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show.
Some children feel fear in places they should feel safe every day. So let's be challenged to speak words of life and encouragement. The next time a student shares a discouragement or difficulty with you, try listening first and then engaging them in compassionate and encouraging conversation.
Read the full article, School Mom Hope, on thestand.net.
The Hamilton Quarter podcast and one-minute commentaries are available at AFR.net. Back to the Hamilton Quarter on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the Hamilton Corner. You know, one of the major things that concerns me in this conversation about the Electoral College is, how many people in our country are completely unaware of why we have an Electoral College? You know, this is one of the things that I've been just lamenting lately. And as I was explaining, if you change to a national popular vote scheme, and most of you, many of you know this already, you would literally transform the portions of our country, you know, that provide food and natural resources to the urban areas of our country. You would literally turn them into political flyover country. Literally. The entire purpose. One of the major debates. I recommend everybody to read James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And it's just sad because as the Marxist effort to persuade Americans that they should hate America, it's included an intentional abandonment of teaching things like civics and economics. I mean, many of you listening to me, when you were being educated, economics was mandatory. You know, civics was mandatory. In a lot of places, it's not. One of the things that the delegates to the Constitutional Convention debated vigorously vigorously, you know, began as a Connecticut Compromise, later or also referred to as a Great Compromise, was how were we going to reconcile the interest of larger states, this is late 18th century, with smaller states. You had a strong anti-federalist penchant. You know, some of the more popular states at the time were Virginia, you know, and you know, you had a lot of populations in other places, and you had smaller states that was like, listen, we're not going to be a part of your national government because y'all are going to just try to steamroll smaller states. And so the Electoral College system was a feature, and this is why I stress the reference to our nation being comprised of a constitutional republic with democratic features, because historically, democratic participation could occur in smaller locales, less geographical sprawl, if you will. But in a larger nation, it's kind of hard to do that. So the notion of representative or representative government was born, combined with the idea of federalism, separate sovereignty, reconcile the necessity of recognizing that states that have higher populations, that's not something we should automatically ignore. So we will have that population represented in the House of Representatives, to where the House of Representatives, the number of representatives from your state is based upon your population. This is why the census is so vitally important. This is why you had people who are arguing that the census should not just count people in the state, but it should count citizens. That's another conversation for another time. And then you had the converse consideration that though we may have varied populations, we also need to have equal representation in the halls of our national legislature, the Congress, so the Senate would reflect that no matter how many citizens you have in your state, that each state will have the exact same number of United States senators, 2 senators per state. And the combination of the representatives you have in your state and the number of senators you have for your state, that will comprise the number of electors you have for your state. Now, we can debate the later adoption of the amendment that changed the way the U.S. senators were elected. I think was a horrible decision, which was not a product of what the founders created, but if you notice, it came right about the time, pretty close to the Federal Reserve Act coming to the fore, right around that time. But regardless, the point that I'm making now is that the Electoral College had a purpose, specifically as it applies to the election of the federal executive, that still stands to this day. With the great diversity between states, we have states that are larger agricultural versus states that are dominated by urban populaces. With all of this cross-pollination and cross-section, we, in order to have an executive elected, require that executive to have a broad appeal. That is the purpose of the Electoral College. That you can't just win the skinny pants crowd with the hair gel and you have no regard for farmers. Y'all understand? Farmers, by their very design, require less people per space, per area, because you need land to grow food. Tim Walz's lie, frankly, we want every vote to count in every state. That's just a lie. You don't want every vote to count in every state. You want to be able to count the votes in a few states, and then the rest you don't have to go to. Tim Walz has signed on to this National Popular Vote Compact, which frankly is unconstitutional. Because if you're going to change the way the federal executive is elected, you have to amend the United States Constitution. You can't just have an in-run around it. The National Popular Vote Compact has states that say, well, you know, if we get enough states to agree to this compact, and if enough of the states comprise 270 Electoral College votes, no matter how our states vote, we agree that we're going to all of our compact states right now, 17 states who've signed off on it, including Minnesota and Maine. We're going to give our Electoral College votes to whoever has the most national popular votes, regardless of how my state voted. So the reality exists, potentially, for Tim Walz's state to vote against the candidate that he prefers, but because he signed on to this compact, he would try to throw his state's Electoral College votes to the national popular vote getter, which is unconstitutional. But among the things, and I want to encourage listeners to this program to do this with your family and friends. Have a conversation. Why do we have an electoral? What is the purpose? How does it function? Too many of our citizens don't have any idea how the Electoral College works, let alone how electors are identified. And it's grievous, but that palpable national ignorance is how you have a people who are easily manipulated and easily moved. You want to talk about easy movement. This next one, this is the one that had Bobby shaking his head earlier. So the FBI puts out annually crime statistics in our nation. Usually the release of the statistics are a year behind where we are currently. So the stats for 2021 normally come out in 2022. All right. The stats for 2022 normally come out in 2023, et cetera, et cetera. They're a year behind because, of course, the tabulation process, right? And there are lots of variables, lots of things that contribute to it. But the main thing I want to point to is in September of 2023. September of 2023, the FBI put out its final, that's air quotes for y'all who are listening and you can't see me, the final crime data for 2022. And it recorded a decrease in violent crime, a decrease in the violent crime rate by 2.1%. After that, I mean, the FBI sent out press releases. You know, you had, you know, publications putting out all kind of data, you know, USA Today and others. Violent crime has fallen for the third straight year in a row. News at 7, you know. That data persisted even up to the President Trump, Vice President Harris debate, to where Mr. Trump was saying, man, crime is on the rise. And David Muir, y'all know old David Muir, fact-checking David Muir step in, the data shows that violent crime is actually on the decline. And Mr. Trump insisted, no, it's not. It's not. Well, and the thing that makes me so upset about this is the way we learned about the revision. Well, 3 weeks ago, the FBI, no press release, no news stories, none of that. The FBI just added a little update, a one-sentence update on the website that said, quote, the 2022 violent crime rate has been updated for inclusion of CIUs in 2023, end quote. That's all that it said. In order to see what was updated, it required you to download the Excel spreadsheets, to download the charts, and compare the charts that are available now to what they released last September. It's information from local municipalities, which causes the question, why didn't they include that in the first time? That's all it said. No press releases, no major stories, nothing. Well, it turns out that little update reveals not only was there not a 2.1% decrease in violent crime. No, in fact, there was a 4.5% increase in violent crime. That's thousands of robberies, assaults, burglaries. That includes murders. Criminal justice expert John Lott talked about this. Listen to and watch clip number 3. Go.
Just give people an idea of the size of the change. When the 2022 data came out in September 2023, they initially reported that violent crime had fallen by 2.1% in 2022. The new data, that's the final data, supposedly, for 2022. The revision of that final data that came out last month now claims that rather than the 2.1% drop, that there was actually a 4.5% increase in violent crime that occurred in 2022. That's a 6.6 percentage point change there. That's from a drop to an increase. And, you know, the bizarre thing to me is for a year after the 2020-22 data was put out, we were having headlines and news articles after news articles saying violent crime is falling. People mistakenly or erroneously believe that it's increasing. And, you know, and they were relying on this data, but you don't see any corrections in the news saying, oops, the FBI data that we relied on was wrong, that rather than a drop, there was actually an increase that had occurred.
Why don't we see that? And so this is what we have going on. People are living in places. They go into a convenience store, a Walgreens, a CVS, and you got the honey buns, and everything is locked up. Everything is locked up. You know, some places, some stores, I would go in New Orleans, they don't even let you exchange with the clerk at the counter. You have this thick bulletproof glass that you have this turnstile. You have to put the item in so they can scan it and put your money in. Places in New York City, you can't buy, you can't go, all the stuff is locked up. Why is it locked up, guys? Because of criminals. And many people are experiencing this all over the country, yet you have the extended pinky folks, the elite folks. No, oh, you guys are, you doth protest too much. Crime is on the decrease. Only you plebeians, you proletarians, you people honest and must be crushed are concerned about crime, because crime is actually on the downturn. And you're like, yo, I live where I live. I see what I see. I don't want to walk my dog at night. I don't want to go on a jog down the street because these people are off the chain with the criminality. And then the FBI comes on the slick. They don't come out. Yeah, by the way, let me read the exact quote. The 2022 violent crime rate has been updated for inclusion. You go figure it out for yourself if you want to. So you got David Muir fact-checking Mr. Trump during the debate. You have all of these people, all of these stories. Crime is down, crime is down, crime is down. And the FBI comes around. Actually. And this is the thing. There's some states, they started voting weeks ago. They didn't get this information. But this information likely affected them, potentially. I'm not trying to throw shade on anybody for early voting, but this is what I'm telling you. This is why they want early voting to happen, guys. And this is just sickening to me. We are living in Orwell's 1984, to where you must not believe your lying eyes. But this is happening. And there are a lot of different things that are happening, underreporting, non-reported crimes, and things of that nature. But even with all of that, the FBI should at least be a bit more forthcoming with their revised statistics.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.